The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Cliven has been grazing his cows on public land for a long time, but he hadn't paid his bills in 20 years. So basically, in 2014, the government says, all right, we're going to come take the cows as payment, like a repossession. Well, Cliven takes to the right-wing media, internet media, starts going to militias and saying, they're coming to get me, they're coming to take my cows, they're coming to kill my family, and we need your help. So it's sort of this miraculous event where people show up from all over the country. I mean, I'm talking New Hampshire, Arizona, Nevada, Oregon. I mean, there are people, Montana, that come there to protect this rancher in what they see as a show of tyrannical force of the government. So what ended up happening is that the Bureau of Land Management agents there that came to get the cows found themselves surrounded on all sides by people that were heavily armed.
I'm Jacob Schultz, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, October 12th, 2019. At his rally in Minneapolis earlier this week, President Trump received voluntary security from an unexpected source, the Oath Keepers, a far-right militia associated with the white supremacy movement. Nor is this the first time that the Trump administration has crossed paths with such groups, which have become more active in recent years. To learn more about these groups, Lawfare senior editor Scott R. Anderson recently sat down with journalist Leah Sottile, who is the host of the podcast Bundyville, which does a deep dive on America's far-right militia movement. Together, they discuss these groups' origins and ideologies, and what they can teach us about homegrown radicalization in modern-day America. It's the Lawfare Podcast, Episode 460, Leah Sottile on Bundyville and American Radicalism.
So, Leah, let's start our conversation where I think your intersection with this sort of issue and set of issues started, and that's with a man named Kevin Harpham. Let me play a clip here for you from Episode 7 of Season 2 of Bundyville.
Breaking news from KXLY4. The FBI confirms a Stevens County man has been arrested in connection with the bomb placed in downtown Spokane on Martin Luther King Jr. Day.
It was a cold winter morning, the day of the Martin Luther King Jr. Parade. The march was planned to go right through the center of the city. A man named Kevin Harpham, a white supremacist from Stevens County, Washington, planted a backpack bomb on the parade route near a metal bench and a brick wall across the street from my favorite bookstore. City workers saw that backpack and called it in. It was filled with wires, and it smelled awful.
And Nadine, of course, you now know that Kevin Harpham left his bomb here at Main and Washington. He intended to use a black powder explosion to spray all those people in that parade with a rain of these lead fishing weights.
Inside was a 6-inch-long pipe bomb packed with fishing weights coated in rat poison and human feces.
And this is going to take out windows. It's potentially going to damage cars. Anybody who's a pedestrian in the immediate vicinity is probably going to be injured and maybe even killed. In
the days after, the fishing weights would have torn through the marchers like a giant shotgun blast.
Harpham had gone as far as to coat his projectiles with rat poison in the hopes the shrapnel would cause uncontrolled bleeding in its victims.
So this pretty horrible attempted attack took place just outside your front door, really. I think you mentioned later in the episode that police tape kind of cut off your entrance and exit to the building. And obviously, it's a pretty dramatic introduction, an intersection between this subject of American extremism and your own life. Tell us a little bit about what we know about Kevin Harpham and the path that led him to this intersection with your life as a journalist in Spokane at the time, not working on these issues.
Sure. Yeah. So what's known about Kevin Harpham is a lot of what's been reported by predominantly by Spokane media, the Spokesman Review in particular. But what they found was that Kevin Harpham was someone who had been interested in white supremacist ideologies and in a lot of the things that fuel the white supremacist movement. He was also a guy that not a lot of people knew. He didn't have a lot of friends. He lived in a rural area of a very rural county in northeastern Washington. And he was well liked by the people who did know him. So a lot of what was known about Harpham was kind of what we hear a lot about a lot of mass shooters and things that, you know, oh, he was such a nice guy, or he was, you know, someone that I knew who he was, but I don't know that I ever talked to him, that sort of thing. So when everything started to come out, it started to look like this was a bombing that was motivated by the white supremacist ideology that he believed in. And in court, that came out too, that he was motivated to bomb that parade because of what he believed about people of color. So that, yeah, that intersected in my own life in that I woke up one day and I wasn't able to go out the front door of my apartment building. And I worked, weirdly, I sort of existed on this one city block in downtown Spokane, Washington, where I lived across the street from the newspaper that I worked at. I worked at the Inlander, the alternative weekly there, and I was a music reporter, an arts reporter primarily. I'd gone to school for journalism, but sort of had a passion for, you know, punk music and heavy metal, and that's what I wrote about most of the time. So I watched as the other reporters in my newsroom worked on this story, and it was a big deal. What I learned by sort of our own coverage was this was something that had been going on in that area for a really long time. And I always knew about it, but the sense that you get when you live in that area for a long time was it went away when the Aryan Nations went away. I think the Harpham bombing is evidence that it didn't go away and that it's still there.
So you now, several years after this 2011 incident, have produced this podcast that does this incredible deep dive into the sort of ecology of social institutions and movements and ideology that is motivating a lot of these sorts of incidents and attacks we see recently. And a big part of that story is one of radicalization, of this socialization of individuals into this ideology that leads to what certainly to many of us seems like pretty extreme, violent, horrible behavior. But there are also other types of radicalization, other types of indoctrination that take place. And you spend a lot of time really in both seasons of Bundyville, but particularly with this new focus in the second season, talking about one of the main figures in this process of kind of indoctrination. And that is someone named Lavoie Finicum. Let me play another clip for you from episode 3 of season 2 of Bundyville, where you talk a little bit about Lavoie and the role that he has come to play in a lot of these right-wing movements.
I've seen Lavoie Finicum die and die and die. I can log onto YouTube right now and watch Finicum's end. Spliced and paused and dissected by people who never knew him.
And seconds later, he dropped to the ground, and as the autopsy shows from the coroner, he was shot 3 times.
Those people, too, have again and again watched his pickup crash, the driver's door fly open.
Okay, we're here.
Finicum hops out as he yells to the police, "You're gonna have to shoot me." Then, 3 bullets. Bang, bang, bang. Dead.
Did they kill him?
Back it up. Play it again. His words sound like a nervous mantra. Start it again. They come across like an unfinished sentence. Are they the start to a threat? A promise? I always think I'll hear some new intonation, some missed revelation, but Finicum always dies the same. 3 pops. He doesn't jump or yelp. He just crumples. Body tense and alive 1 second, a heavy sack of bones dropped to the ground for eternity the next. A puppet without a hand. Gravity that's stronger than spirit. Death on repeat. It's what Finicum is known for.
Now, later in this episode, you describe Finicum as a martyr made at the speed of the internet. He goes from this background of a pretty standard history, somebody with a pretty maybe standard set of some successes, a number of disappointments in an adult life, and then goes to have this really exceptional ending to his life, and then an even more exceptional afterlife that plays into this broader system of, again, these ideologies that are motivating some of his behavior. Let's start with the man himself. Give us a little background about Lavoie Finicum and his life before he began, set himself down on this path that ended in his death in 2016.
Sure. So Lavoie Finicum, Robert Lavoie Finicum is his full name. He was a rancher from northern Arizona. And the first time he sort of comes onto the scene is during the 2016 occupation of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge, when Ammon Bundy and his brother Ryan Bundy led an armed occupation of a federal property there in southeastern Oregon. Finicum shows up, and pretty quickly the Bundys start having these press conferences every day where they're sort of telling people what the heck is going on and why they're even there in the first place. And Finicum is often there speaking to reporters, and he's an interesting guy. I mean, immediately I was interested in who he was and what his story was when he was at the refuge, which is really when the story caught my interest, because he was just so mild-mannered and so easy to talk to. Reporters were having just these great long interviews with him and kind of these philosophical conversations. So Finicum is actually one of the only ranchers that showed up to this, you know, quote unquote, ranchers protest at the refuge. And he first became involved with the Patriot movement, apparently, during the Bundy Ranch standoff in 2014. So what I did with this season of Bundyville was I wanted to get like a definitive life story of who Finicum was, because really everything I read started in like 2014, and that was only the last 2 years of his life. And so I wanted to know who he was in the previous 50 some odd years. So what it turns out to be is that he was a rural guy, grew up in a Mormon family on the Navajo reservation. And he always wanted to be a cowboy, and he couldn't quite make that dream of being a cowboy work. He lived all over the West. He was married several times. He had a bunch of kids, 12 total, and then he became a foster parent. So when he arrived on the scene of the Patriot Movement, as I like to say, in 2016, he was just known around northern Arizona as this mild-mannered, decent rancher who raised a lot of foster kids. So he was sort of an outlier, I think, for this movement, in that he wasn't in a militia and he hadn't been rallying against the government for a long time like Cliven Bundy had. He was just this sort of perfect person in the end for the movement. And even in season one, when I sat down with Cliven Bundy and his son Ryan Bundy, they talked about how Lavoie really was this perfect spokesman for their movement because he was so likable by people on every part of the spectrum. So like you say, and like you played in that clip, you know, I kind of drill down into why the heck he got involved in this in the first place.
So you mentioned two things that I want to flesh out here for our listeners who may not be familiar with them. One of those is the Patriot Movement itself. And then you've mentioned the Bundys a number of times, Cliven Bundy and a number of other Bundys, and the role they played in this 2014 incident in Bunkerville that got Lavoie Finicum involved in this Patriot Movement. Give us more background, a little bit of short background on that, and then leading up to Lavoie's involvement. What was he stepping into when he showed up in 2014?
Okay, so first, the Patriot Movement has been around a really long time. It's people who oftentimes are in militias. They're maybe against paying their taxes. They have pretty strong ideas about the government. And there have been multiple big instances in the Patriot Movement's history where they clashed very publicly with the government in often violent and bloody ways. One of those in particular is the 1992 Ruby Ridge standoff in northern Idaho, where a man and his family were living in a really remote area of Idaho, and he failed to show up to court. And so U.S. Marshals came out to bring him to court, and what ensued was this long standoff that resulted in many people dying, both members of the Weaver family, and in particular, one was a child, and also U.S. Marshals. So that's a moment in time, I think, that really exemplifies a lot of what the Patriot Movement believes, that the government is so oppressive and tyrannical that it'll come after people who want to live their own way. So in 2014, we saw another big kind of Ruby Ridge-esque event play out in Bunkerville, Nevada. That's right down in the very southern part of Nevada. It's about 90 miles away from Las Vegas, a rural area, but not the most rural area that you can go to in the West. But it's where Cliven Bundy has lived much of his life. And he is a cattle rancher there. And he's one of the last, if not the last, cattle rancher in Clark County, Nevada. And for the past 20 years, he has not paid his bills to the federal government. So when you ranch in the West or around, the United States, you oftentimes have to take out a grazing permit with a federal agency. In his case, it's the Bureau of Land Management. And basically, there are public lands all over the country that Americans can use to recreate or, do all kinds of things on. But one of those uses is for ranching. And in order to do that, you have to have a grazing permit where the government says, yeah, this is public land, but you are allowed to graze your cows here. So Cliven has been grazing his cows on public land for, for a long time, but he hadn't paid his bills in 20 years. So basically, in 2014, the government says, all right, we're going to come take the cows as payment, like a repossession. And so they plan this big roundup. Well, Cliven takes to the right-wing media, internet media, starts going to militias and saying, they're coming to get me, they're coming to take my cows, they're coming to kill my family, and we need your help in facing them off. So it's sort of this miraculous event where people show up from all over the country. I mean, I'm talking New Hampshire, Arizona, Nevada, Oregon. I mean, there are people, Montana, that come there to protect this rancher in what they see as a show of tyrannical force of the government. So what ended up happening is that the Bureau of Land Management agents there that came to get the cows found themselves surrounded on all sides by people that were heavily armed, and they stood down. And that was seen as a real victory for the Patriot Movement. There were some other things that happened during that event in which one of Cliven's sons was tased by a Bureau of Land Management officer, and there were dogs that were nipping at the crowd. A woman was knocked to the ground, and the Bundys continue today to show that the government was the aggressor coming at them, and so they were just defending themselves. But that whole event was grounded in this idea that the federal government just doesn't have a right to, charge people money to use public land, that the public land doesn't even exist, and that the federal government has no business telling people in Nevada what to do. So like I said, it was seen as a real victory for the Patriot Movement. It was seen as a time when American citizens pointed guns at federal officials and got away with it. And, I think had that not happened, then in 2016, Cliven Bundy's two sons, Ammon and Ryan, would not have traveled to Oregon to take over a federal wildlife refuge there. Now, the 2016 event is different in that what they did there is that they went into the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge, which is, I had lived in Oregon almost my entire life at that point, and I did not know that refuge was even there. It's a bird refuge. And, you see a lot of older people, in kind of like outdoorsy clothing and binoculars that go there to look at birds and enjoy the outdoors. They came there and seized that property and said, we're not leaving until this is handed back to the people of Harney County, which is the county that was in. But it also coincided with this pretty dramatic case of two ranchers in Oregon in that area that had land bordering the refuge that were convicted of setting fire on federal land. Basically, you know, people use fire in the West to control. It helps prevent wildfires. They burn off, you know, crops and things like that to be able to replant. This fire in particular got out of control and was also suspected they were actually poaching deer illegally. So these ranchers were hauled to jail. They were given a mandatory minimum sentence of 5 years, but the judge in the case said that just seems egregious. And I think he said it would shock the conscience that that's what they should serve. So these men, this father and son ranching duo, went to jail for less than 5 years, were released, and then on appeal, they were hauled back to jail. So the Bundys took over the refuge sort of in this show of force that they thought that was another example of a tyrannical government controlling people. So that's kind of the Bundy story in a nutshell.
Well, that's great. That's season one of the show right there.
So
you mentioned this ideological perspective that the Bundys and presumably many of those who joined them in 2014 share. This is criticism of the federal government's ownership of land and their ability to even own land legally under the Constitution or under what the other system of natural law you think applies. What other aspects of ideology are the Bundys bringing to the table, though? Because there's not just a secular kind of constitutional critique. There's also a religious aspect of this.
There is, yeah. So season one of Bundyville was a really interesting exercise. I mean, they both were. But in that one, I wanted to know sort of why Clive and Bundy got these ideas about the federal government not being able to own land. And, you know, they treat the Constitution as if it's a holy text. The Bundys are also very religious people. They're Mormons, they're LDS. And I wanted to know if there was just some part of their ideology, their religious ideology that led to it. So to these standoffs and these ideas. And it turns out there was. So in season one of Bundyville, we talk a bit about this document that was given to me called the Nay Book. It's a, you know, really it's not a book. It's like a packet of papers. But it shows how Clive and Bundy and his neighbor, another LDS man named Keith Nay, who has since passed, they basically got together all the time to talk about Mormon scripture. And what they did is they assembled all the pieces of scripture that they thought affirmed their belief that the LDS people would be the final protectors of the Constitution in the end times, and that at some point they would be forced to, basically the Constitution would be hanging by a thread, in their words, and they would be the ones that would be forced to protect it, and they would be saved because of that. So it sort of blew my mind a little bit that this sort of salvation narrative was tied up with this United States document. And so I actually went to Bundy Ranch and I talked to them about the Nay Book and what that was. And it was interesting because, I mean, I talked to LDS scholars all over the country and they said, this is bizarre. This is not what the church agrees with. And I actually got a statement from the Mormon church saying, this is not what we condone. And it's based on a prophecy. And I say that with quotes around it, supposedly that the Mormon prophet Joseph Smith maybe said that the Mormon people would be the final protectors of the Constitution. But most of the LDS church thinks of that as kind of this urban legend. But with the Bundys, you saw people not only not thinking it was an urban legend, but doubling down on it. And actually, since releasing Bundyville season one, what I've found out from a lot of people is that prophecy, the so-called prophecy, which is called the White Horse Prophecy, is more believed in around the American West than a lot of people would like to let on. So the Bundys in that regard, you know, they you know, made this book and distributed this packet, this Nay Book packet, and kind of leaned hard, obviously, into that belief system. But a lot of people contacted me after Bundyville and season one saying, yeah, I learned that. And I also learned that we weren't supposed to talk about it. So that was interesting.
Wow. So Lavoie Finicum shows up in 2014 in this situation. Up until this point, as you know in the podcast, you know, he had faced a lot of setbacks, but seemed to be kind of as close as he'd gotten to this dream of being a rancher and family man. He had a wife, several kids, foster children, was at least actively ranching, although I'm sure it's not always easy, had a normal life, on top of which had a normal relationship with groups like the Bureau of Land Management, was up on his payments, unlike the Bundys. What happens after 2014? How does it change the trajectory of Finicum's life?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Finicum showed up there and found a lot of like-minded people who maybe had been hearing a lot of the same things about the government that he had through his life. I mean, when Finicum showed up in 2014 and heard these ideas about the government being, this big bad guy, it was not the first time he heard that. That was something that had been heard through his life, but what he saw there, I think he was so invigorated by it and saw that maybe there was a real show of force that rural people could have. He left Bundy Ranch and really drastically changed his behavior and his interactions with the federal government. So before he went, he was in good standing with the BLM. He paid all of his bills on time. You know, he'd have long conversations with these guys that were land managers out there. But afterwards, I was able to get a bunch of letters through FOIA requests that he had written to the BLM office there in his area. And he said, I just have to take a stand and I'm not going to pay my bills anymore, basically. And there was this real kind of back and forth that was interesting of like, Lavoie, what are you talking about? What? Why? And he just felt that he had to stand up against the government in this sort of image that Cliven Bundy had showed that he did. And Finicum was really public about that all of a sudden he was going to stop paying his bills and he was going to stand with other ranchers. He had this YouTube channel where he would talk about it a lot. But behind the scenes, through other court documents that I found, it sounded like he was actually trying to plan some sort of violent confrontation with the government as well. And that's the part that I think that, his family doesn't like to hear people talk about and, that they have not been happy with Bundyville about, because supposedly he was saying to Bill Keebler, a militia man that we talk about in Bundyville season 2, that he wanted to be like the guy in front of the tank at Tiananmen Square, and that, if he died, the cause would be the poor rancher's widow. And so he was sort of planning this violent interaction with the BLM and planning that they were going to come in and take his cattle. But by the time he died, he really had only racked up a little over $1,000 in grazing fees. And it took the government 20 years to come get Cliven Bundy. So I think he was sort of living under this sort of illusion that if he died or that if he did something, it would lead to some progress. But it's pretty unclear what that world would look like, I guess, if he was successful.
So Finicum faces this dramatic ending that we heard described in the clip we played just a few minutes ago. And it's one that's particularly dramatic because it's this kind of impromptu confrontation where they departed the reserve briefly. They had this confrontation. Other people in the vehicle end up surrendering. Finicum is vocally a little more resisting. And it's being caught on media from all directions. There is not only video from the outside, there's also, people inside the car with him recording. You can hear some of them in the clip we played saying, did they shoot him? Did they shoot him? And all of this media does create this effect that you described so well of being able to see this death in replay from 1,000 perspectives over and over again on social media, on the internet. And it leads to Finicum becoming this something more than just a man, to having this pretty exceptional afterlife facilitated in part by his surviving wife and others. Describe for us a little bit what his legacy has been and what role he's come to play in these broad sorts of broader movements.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, something really exceptional, like you say, about this video of his shooting death, because immediately after it happened, I think that the FBI and the government tried to get in front of what they figured would be, conspiracies about it. And so they released this footage, this aerial footage that was taken by a drone that was over the traffic stop and followed Finicum's truck as he drove away from police. And it didn't have any audio and things like that. And they just released it, and that came out really quickly. Well, then almost just as quickly came out this cell phone video from inside the car, where you hear, you know, the people in the car, you know, being really scared about what's happening and sort of talking about what they can do and if they can call in for help. And, you know, and then after Finnegan is shot, you know, the sound of the window shattering and tear gas being, you know, blown in and that kind of thing. So it rounds out this story a little bit more. And I think that being able to splice those two videos together and show it from inside the car and outside the car, it ended up being that people see it a million different ways. So, you know, one way that people see it is that here was this man who was involved in a prolonged armed standoff with other people who believe that the government is oppressive and tyrannical, people who are very well armed. And all of a sudden, he's fleeing away from a traffic stop. He's jumping out of a car saying, "You're gonna have to shoot me." And he gets shot and killed while reaching inside of his jacket. So people see it one way as a justified police shooting. On the other hand, you have people who see that very same video and take away totally different things. They take away that here's this man who's scared. He's saying, "I'm going to go talk to the sheriff in the next county over, who happens to be a constitutional sheriff who believes many, if not all, of the same things that informed the refuge standoff." And that he was simply fleeing to speak with law enforcement he agreed with, that he wouldn't have carried a gun inside of his jacket pocket, that he was simply slipping and stumbling in this deep snow. They don't seem to have much of an explanation for why he was saying, "You're going to have to shoot me." But this is just to say that this video that was meant to sort of like cut off conspiracy theories just led to wild conspiracy theories in the end. So in the end, Finicum becomes this martyr for this movement in a way that, you know, the Waco standoff in the mid-90s that people saw what the government did there and the people there who died were seen as martyrs, or what happened at Ruby Ridge, those people were seen as martyrs. So Finicum became this sort of perfect character for people to say, look at this rural man who was just trying to stand up for his rights. And that's what he's become. And so now, you know, Finicum, that name, here's this man who ranched in the middle of nowhere, who it was known by almost no one, has become so well known throughout the world because of his videos and now his cattle brand. I mean, you can see it everywhere. People have it tattooed on their bodies, their bumper stickers and t-shirts and hats and, you know, songs that have been written about him. And in the name Lavoie is something that is seen as like almost like a holy, like a Jesus-like figure. And that has become very powerful, I think, in recruiting new people to the movement.
Now, part of that was organic. You can see that with the social media environment that we have. You're getting these really dramatic clips, dramatic developments. But part of it wasn't organic. Part of it was a conscious effort by people who are kind of, I don't want to say necessarily manufacturing, but packaging elements of his legacy and kind of using that and communicating that to certain audiences. You sat down for Bundyville Season 2 and listened to one of these shows led by, I believe, Mr. Finicum's wife. Can you give us a little sense of what the use that people have made of his legacy and what role it's continuing to play as a tool or as a product that certain people are disseminating?
Sure. Yeah. So I believe it's episode 3 of season 2, I go to this 3-year anniversary event that was in the Oregon capital, Salem, where people were gathering to sort of honor and remember Lavoie and talk about his legacy. And, you know, what brought me there was sort of these two very disparate images of his death, but also, you know, I don't know a lot of people who have died who get, you know, anniversary commemorations of their death in such a big way. So really, I wanted to go and just hear what was being talked about there. And what light he was being painted in. So Jeanette Finnicum, his wife, has made these movies about his life. And I figured, you know, well, what better way to understand the rest of those 50 some odd years of his life than going and watching this video? What I found is that her videos really only play to this very specific end cap of his life that we've discussed today, and didn't give a whole lot more information. And what I watch is that information rippled through the crowd that was there. It was all stuff that everyone already knew, but it was like they wanted to keep remembering it and talking about it. And as I was sitting there, I looked at my producer, Ryan Haas, who, you know, has become my reporting partner in this whole thing just because it's such a gigantic story. And I was like, this is like church. And he said, yeah, it is church. Like, there are songs and things, you know, when people repeat the same thing over and over that they know already and watch a shooting video that they've seen thousands of times, it feels like a group of people who just want to remember that moment that they all became, I guess, radicalized in a way. That maybe they were on the fence and they saw the shooting video and it pushed them over into the movement. So, but also, you know, was interesting to see the types of people that were there. You know, they were predominantly white, predominantly older folks, but also this image of Finnicum is sort of wrapped up in a religiosity and an Americanism that felt very specific to me, very, very specifically Christian and very specifically white. And that's really who Jeanette Finnicum has shown this video to. You know, I asked for a copy of the video and was not able to get any. I couldn't purchase one or anything like that. That may have changed at this point, but she chooses pretty specifically who this message is given to. And that kind of just led me on this, you know, trip of Bundyville season two of trying to figure out, like, well, who else sees LaVoie as a martyr? And what are people willing to do for a martyr? I mean, right? Like, we see people doing a lot of things for a martyr. You know, Jesus is a martyr. And, you know, you hear people talk all the time within this movement about the fear of Muslims and suicide bombers and martyring themselves. And it started to feel really similar in regards to LaVoie. So yeah, that's kind of LaVoie the martyr that we uncovered.
Well, so you mentioned that, you know, these videos are being brought to particular communities and particular areas. It's a roadshow. It's kind of going on different parts of the West. But you really pick one part of the country to kind of focus on as perhaps emblematic of what's happening in a broader region in different pockets around, particularly the American West, but really the broader United States as well. And that's Stevens County, Washington. Let's listen to a brief clip here where you kind of introduce Stevens County to the Bundyville audience.
You might think of the northwestern U.S. as all rain showers and mountains and Nirvana records, coffee shops and weed stores on every corner, right? But this part of the Northwest I'm about to tell you about, eastern Washington and North Idaho, it actually couldn't be less in line with that image. It's a deeply conservative area of the West. It's hot and dry in the summer, cold as hell in the winter. In the past few years, some people have started to call this region the American Redoubt. A redoubt is a kind of military fortification, and they've been encouraging libertarians and preppers from around the country to make a home here. There are even redoubt realtors who will sell you a house complete with a bomb shelter. So this episode is about Stevens County, but it's also about this region as a whole. And you can't talk about the violent history of Stevens County without first understanding the Aryan Nations.
So you mentioned the Aryan Nations once before and the important role they play, particularly in kind of the upper Northwest and this evolution of Stevens County and related, you know, patriot movements and related movements there. Give us some background on that. What was the Aryan Nation and how did it impact the trajectory of Stevens County?
Yeah, so the Aryan Nations was located in northern Idaho, so actually not in Stevens County at all. And it was situated there in the late 70s by a man named Richard Butler. Butler was a white supremacist, and he created this kind of home base for white supremacists around the country at the Aryan Nations compound in North Idaho. And he also fashioned himself a preacher and had a church called the Church of Jesus Christ Christian, which practiced Christian identity, which is an ideology that believes that Jews are the spawn of Eve and Satan. And, you know, Christian identity takes on a lot of different forms, but it's something that really appealed to a lot of white supremacists. There's a history of it appealing to white supremacists. So the Aryan Nations was there for a long time, you know, up until the 80s and into the early 90s. Richard Butler and his friends would host these big, you know, Nazi parades in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, in this kind of cute little resort town. And people would come out in droves to protest it. And it was sort of this, you know, very, very public clash of these ideas and free speech and racism and this sort of racist cloak, I think, that always is hanging over the Northwest. So at a certain point, for a variety of circumstances we get into the podcast, the Aryan Nations shuts down and he loses the property and it's bulldozed. But when that happened, you know, I think a lot of people thought, well, the Nazis are gone. They're going to move somewhere else. But that really wasn't the case. I mean, there were a lot of people in the area that were excited about those ideas. And I think they just kind of fanned out, or they just went home to where they always were. And one of those nearby counties in eastern Washington. So it's sometimes, I think, hard for people to understand that there's just in Oregon and Washington in particular, you have these very blue, democratic, progressive cities that are on the western side of the state. In the middle of the state, you have these gigantic mountains. And the east sides of the state are very rural, very conservative. And Stevens County and all this stuff is very, it's so much closer to Idaho, to where the Aryan Nations was, than to any of that progressiveness of the west side. So Stevens County, Ponderay County, Ferry County, these are all these big, huge counties that are really close to Idaho, where they've been known for a long time as places that people who just don't want to be around cities, who want to get out of society, can go and really be left alone. I think that's one thing that anybody who spent time in the rural West knows, that there are people there who just don't want to be bothered. And Stevens County is absolutely one of those places. So we get into Stevens County specifically because, not because it's where the Aryan Nations was, but it's because there were, in this, you know, huge, sparsely populated rural county, there is a history of these Christian identity churches being there, these churches that believe, you know, in an anti-Semitic ideology. And there have been really violent white supremacists that have come from those places, particularly Kevin Harpum, who we talked about at the top of the show. So that's kind of why we get into the Aryan Nations and use that as a way to talk about, you know, this history in this area that has led to, you know, these sort of racist ideas persisting there. And we talk about how Jeanette Finnicum brings her video about her husband to this secretive, closed religious compound in Stevens County that is led by people who were foundational framers of some of Christian identity's most important ideas.
So, you know, we've got a few different kind of movements interacting at this point. We have the Patriot Movement associated with the Bundys. We have the Aryan Nations, which was, you know, particularly prominent in this area in the 80s and 90s. Then we have, you know, interactions with both religious identities and ones that are more anti-government. Do they interact? What's their relationship? And how do they have this kind of mix of these strains in Stevens County? Are there major branches of differences, or is there kind of a cross-fertilization that tends to happen?
Yeah, I think, you know, the Patriot Movement is kind of one of those umbrella terms that captures a lot of people who are really suspicious about the government. So, you know, like I said earlier, you'll find like militias and sovereign citizens and tax protesters and people who are sort of, you know, preppers or survivalists. And that's not to say that everyone that considers themselves a, you know, a quote unquote member of the Patriot Movement is a white supremacist, but in these movements, they often welcome white supremacists in their ranks, which I think is suspicious. So, like, for example, during the 2016 occupation of the wildlife refuge, the Bundys were called, you know, racists and things like that. And they were like, we're not racist. But within their ranks of the people leading the occupation were white supremacists. So I think in Stevens County, it's sort of the same thing, that there's people with racist ideas. There are people who are just, you know, don't want the government to own land or don't want to pay their taxes, kind of intermingling and uniting. I guess in these instances, like we've seen with the Bundys and the standoffs that they led, you see a lot of people with different ideas kind of agreeing on the principal, you know, nugget that drove those. So I think that's the case in Stevens County. I think it's the case in a lot of counties in the West.
I think a lot of people in the United States, particularly those in East or in urban areas who don't encounter, you know, these sorts of groups or ideologies very often, are a little dismissive sometimes. You know, you mentioned that during the 2016 Malheur event that people started referring to the occupiers of the reserve as Al-Qaeda or Vanilla ISIS, terms obviously kind of being a little bit derogatory and non-serious towards them. But it can be more serious than that. Can you describe for us a little bit what the presence of these sorts of groups, both the Aryan Nations and these kind of successor groups, has meant for people in Stevens County as part of the country, particularly those who aren't perhaps white and Christian who live there?
Yeah, I think people of color in Stevens County, you know, have maybe took a little relief in that what we talked about in Bundyville season two, just that we're like, hey, this stuff has been there and it's still there. And maybe we should question that instead of make fun of it or say, well, you know, if you talk about the Aryan Nations or you talk about Christian identity, you're just giving those people more attention and perhaps helping them do their recruiting. I think that that's the case. But, you know, I think it's important also to add that in the West and in Stevens County, these are not prominent ideologies. So, you know, we could see that as evidenced in Nevada. You know, the Bundys are a huge name. And Ryan Bundy ran for governor last year and only got, you know, he got such a small sliver of the vote. He was not even considered a serious candidate. So I think that's just to show that there are people who are willing to come to the sides of the people in this movement and you know, fight for them, but they're not a gigantic group.
Well, you know, in spite of the fact that these aren't necessarily dominant ideologies, they are ones that have pretty prominent spokespeople, and that includes some people in the United States government. One you spend a fair amount of time on that I think we have to talk about is Representative, perhaps former Representative Matt Shea from Washington State Legislature. Let me play the clip where you kind of introduce Mr. Shea in part for the podcast here.
For a guy who never talks to the media, Matt Shea sure makes a lot of headlines, often for saying and doing things that might ruin other politicians. Like back in 2009, he talked with conspiracy king Alex Jones on InfoWars about how they both believe the feds are setting up concentration camps to imprison Americans.
Representative, good to have you on with us.
Thank you for having me.
Conspiracy theories have always been a part of Shea's public persona. When Alex Jones teed up the FEMA camp story, Matt Shea took a swing.
Well, I am aware of what you're talking about with the FEMA camps. What's very and most particularly disturbing about that is that they're going to be on former military bases. A ton of people have expressed their concerns that what they're really building are prison camps. I think you're just
here. He is on stage right at a militia rally in 2013.
If you do not have 5,000 rounds of .223, 5,000 rounds of .22, and 1,000 rounds of handgun ammo as a minimum, you're wrong.
At the same rally, he talked about the government collapsing like it was an opportunity, a chance to get stuff done.
We want to prepare for the inevitable collapse that's going to happen. And yes, I said that as a politician here on stage. It's going to happen. We all know that. The question is, and I think the question should be for all of us, what are we going to do afterwards? What are we going to do with that opportunity? What are we going to do to prepare ourselves for that time?
Now, Representative Shea is associated with a couple of pretty out there ideas, but that have this obviously the constituency that he keeps coming back to Stevens County for, that appeals to him or that he appeals to. One of them is this idea of the new state of liberty, turning the American Redoubt into potentially a separate state, kind of focus on autonomy. And another one arguably relates to a document, although he may contest this, that leaked a few years ago called The Biblical Basis for War. Can you describe for us these kind of two separate ideas, how they relate to each other and how they fit into what appears to be Matt Shea's kind of political ideology?
Yeah. So Matt Shea is from Spokane Valley, which is a city actually separate than Spokane, where I used to live, but nearby, borders Idaho. And he spends all this time, like you say, kind of campaigning around Eastern Washington with this idea of this state of liberty. It's this idea to create a 51st state where Eastern Washington would be severed off into its own place. And part of that gets to this idea I was talking to you earlier about, you know, that Seattle in Washington and Portland in Oregon, they are the population centers and they dominate politics and they dominate, you know, the way laws go. And there is a very real thing in Washington where people in rural areas feel like their vote just doesn't matter. And so what Shea is doing is kind of capitalizing on that idea and saying, well, then let's make our own state. Like, let's take our ball and go home. And so he talks about this idea. It's not a new idea. In fact, I talked to Matt Shea, which is almost impossible to do. And he even said that it's not a new idea. I'm not the first person to have this idea, but I think he's probably the person who's the most serious about it. And, you know, he wants to, Shea is also a politician who he spends very little time in Spokane Valley. He went to the 2014 Bundy Ranch standoff in Nevada. He went to the 2016 occupation of the wildlife refuge. He talks about these FEMA camps being built to imprison Americans. He says you need to prepare for the apocalypse. So last year, this document is leaked to the media by a former security staffer of his. It's called The Biblical Basis for War. And I'm laughing because it's wacky. I mean, it's this outline of ideas that he supposedly wrote down from a sermon. And it advocates for, you know, a certain way of life that is based on the Bible, that is based in Christianity, that is based on the Old Testament, to be honest. And if people don't comply with this supposed new society based on these principles, you know, quote, kill all males. If you know, same-sex marriage continues, you know, if things like that aren't repealed, then kill people. And the crazy part is like that kind of thing leaks to the media and most politicians, I think, would say like, I have nothing to do with that. I don't know what that is. But Shea like doubled down and was like, yeah, I did write that down, but it was the sermon I heard. So I think like you see these ideas intermingling in that people start then seeing this state of liberty idea as less of a like appeal to rural voters to have a voice and more like Matt Shea trying to set up a biblically governed state that where, you know, marijuana is illegal and same-sex marriage is illegal and women have fewer rights and all kinds of things. So that, you know, when the Biblical Basis for War came out, that's how it was interpreted, that this was this sort of plan for this new society he hopes to lead.
And so Representative Shea's kind of gotten caught up in a few scandals that none of which have quite led, however, to his defeat electorally so far. In 2014, you guys describe he was overheard by a waitress discussing plans with the Oath Keepers, a militia group who actually called them in because she thought they were a terrorist group planning a terrorist attack. He has various times been linked to plans to surveil, you know, religious institutions for non-Christian groups and other organizations that, you know, don't seem to fit with his ideology and these other sort of extreme actions. Most recently, he's kind of come under some more heat in relation to this biblical basis for war because of other interactions he had, which you also, I think, play a recording of in the podcast with this group called Team Rugged, which is actually training kind of young adolescent men in the use of firearms and the use of other sorts of military tactics, implicitly in preparation or perhaps explicitly in preparation for some sort of action or some sort of movement in the future. Can you describe for us, what is the current state of Matt Shea? What is he dealing with in Washington State? Is there finally a sort of critical mass raising these concerns that may impact his political future?
No, I don't think there is. What is going on with Matt Shea is that he is under investigation for one of these scandals that you meant. Actually, you didn't mention, but it is one of the dozens of scandals, I guess, that Matt Shea's career is becoming defined by. So a bunch of text messages were leaked that Shea was involved with, where he and other, right-wing figures, prominent redoubters, were talking about committing violence against liberal protesters. And in that, Matt Shea offered to background those people. So he's under investigation right now to look more into the story, I guess, of those text messages. So, but yeah, he's also involved with this group in Stevens County called Marble Community Fellowship, Disclosed Religious Community that we talk about in the podcast. And it's at that religious community that this group, Team Rugged, which is, you know, a lot of like teenage, maybe like lower 20s boys, are training in the art of biblical war, is what they say. And they're being led by the pastor of that fellowship. And Matt Shea in a video is saying, wow, you guys are awesome and stuff. So it's sort of like this whole world around Shea is like this biblical basis for war and this sort of vigilance against liberals and preparing for this sort of end, I guess, is it. So that, you know, as Bundyville came out, as Jason Wilson from The Guardian has been reporting, as Chad Sokol at the Spokesman Review has been reporting, and Daniel Walters at The Inlander, you know, there's been a lot of stories that have come out about Shea. And I think in one regard, it's made people in Washington State more aware that he's there. But in his district, I think it's caused him to maybe have even more support because they see these things and they don't like the media. And he has a fundraiser with like way more people than maybe would have been there before any of this happened. So it's really hard to say what is going to happen with Shea, whether he will be ousted. I don't think that anybody should put much stock in that. He's been voted in for 6 consecutive terms. So there are people who believe in what he believes. And I don't know that they've been deterred by any of these scandals.
Now, of course, Matt Shea isn't the only politician whose rhetoric and ideas and ideology at least intersects or has a relationship with some of these other ideas. You note that there are at least some parallels and touch points with some of President Trump's rhetoric and some of the ideas appealed to or brought up in this broader narrative that Shea kind of represents at least one end of the spectrum of. You know, and there are ties between the Trump administration and the Bundys and some of these other movements in small ways. The President Trump, of course, pardoned the Hammonds, the two people who suspected of starting the fire that led to the Mueller occupation. Ultimately, William Penley, his acting director, meaning not subject to Senate confirmation, Bureau of Land Management, someone who's publicly argued the federal government shouldn't be able to legally hold land. And is proceeding with a plan to reassign something like between 80 and 90% of the Bureau of Land Management staff from Washington, D.C. to the American West. What is the relationship between perhaps more mainstream ideology, particularly some of the ideas being brought forward by kind of the Trump wing of the Republican Party, and these other ideologies? And is there a bit of a relationship between the two beyond just, you know, common touch points of criticism of the federal government?
Yeah, I think, you know, one thing that I notice more and more is the support that President Trump has from evangelical Christians, that, you know, despite being a fairly crass man and having some pretty bold, strange, often perverse things to say, he continues to maintain a lot of support from Christians. And I think that definitely plays into the Bundyville story, in that there are a lot of people who may look at these things about Matt Shea and be horrified at the idea of people being killed. But at the end of the day, they're gonna support a Christian, and that's a lot of what they see. You know, I also thought it was interesting a few weeks ago when President Trump was saying in a speech, and you know, it feels like every day is like a million days. I can't remember what the story was, but he said, "I am the chosen one," you know, in a speech, and was sort of talking like he's like this king. And that felt very, very much in line with this kind of Old Testament, old world ideas that you hear in sort of the bowels of the Patriot movement, particularly in Stevens County.
So one thing I think we've come to the realization of, particularly in light of this string of horrible shootings and other domestic terrorist attacks that we're continuing to wrestle with, is the challenge that right-wing domestic terrorism really poses for law enforcement, particularly for federal law enforcement. On the one side, these are ideologies premised upon the idea of an oppressive federal government and aggressive law enforcement tactics, you know, SWAT raids, undercover missions, and things that may look like entrapment feed into that narrative in a lot of ways. They echo a lot of the strategies that the people who embrace these Patriot Movement ideologies say the federal government is pursuing to trap them. And a lot of those ideologies are inherently victimhood ideologies, a belief that certain parts of the population, in many cases white and Christian parts of the population, are being unfairly prosecuted by the federal government. Feeding into that seems dangerous. At the same time, these groups are potentially violent, and there is a real interest and federal interest in getting what is often described as left of boom, at taking preventive law enforcement action that can prevent acts of terrorism like the one that you experienced that kind of set you down this path in 2011, or almost experienced, I should say. And on top of that, as you mentioned, there are these phenomena of these constitutional sheriffs of local law enforcement buying into these ideologies, maybe not taking the steps that one would hope they would take to counteract, particularly where these groups have these geographic areas that are predominantly under their control, or at least, you know, sympathetic to them. What kind of lessons have you pulled away from being a very close observer of these over the last few years of these trends that might inform how federal law enforcement, or really any law enforcement, or the broader United States government should approach these movements and these acts as a matter of public policy?
It's an interesting question. I mean, I think we talk a bit at the end of this latest season about how, you know, domestic terrorism is something a lot of people aren't even sure exists. They hear that term and they're not quite sure what it means. You know, I talk to dozens of people involved in law enforcement at all different levels who talk about that these groups, you know, militias and white supremacist groups and, you know, groups of skinheads, they have been around for a long time, and a long time in the West, in both the urban and rural West. And yet they're not seeming to take, you know, law enforcement doesn't seem to take them as seriously. You know, in Portland, where I live, you see that there are at times it seems like people, law enforcement are being sympathetic to those groups, that there's a long history of police officers engaging with groups with racist ideologies. So there's just, you know, this idea of terrorism, I think, living in a post 9/11 world through the media, through politicians, we've sort of been spooned to this idea of what a terrorist is. And the argument that we make in Bundyville is that, you know, terrorism is not a thing streaming over the southern border. It is something that is here. It's homegrown. It's American. It's white. It's Christian. And I think that that's something that, you know, some law enforcement, a lot of law enforcement I have talked to absolutely agrees with, and they don't think enough is being done. So I think that, you know, instead of introducing new laws, new domestic terrorism statutes, the existing things that we have in place should be used. You know, hate crimes can be prosecuted, things of that nature. But also, I think just transparency about what's going, you know, who's being looked into and who the real, I guess, danger is as far as terrorism in America. in a lot of cases, it's these groups, or it's subsidiaries of these groups. You know, my reporting in a lot of ways has shown that the people who tend to be most dangerous are not necessarily the guys on Facebook, like fighting about, you know, militias and the Second Amendment. It tends to be people who are in far-flung areas, who aren't in, you know, posting about, you know, all their ideas and that sort of thing. They're not known. And I don't know what the solution is to fixing that, but I think just an awareness that there are people out there that, you know, have pretty radical ideas about the government and are willing to commit violence in the name of those ideas. I think that we need to know that those are predominantly white Americans that are doing that.
And that really leads into, I think, my last question for you, which is that, you know, since the 9/11 attacks, a lot of this us, and I put myself in this group of people who are, you know, policy makers or policy experts, people like who think about national security and really made a career focusing on it, have had a long conversation about what radicalization looks like from the outside in, looking at foreign countries and foreign societies, at times maybe intersecting with Americans if we're thinking about, you know, American Muslims or these other ideas, but often in a very specific context that is, you know, thinking of radicalization in many ways, kind of thinking of it as an other, as this a foreign concept, and thinking about what it means for these other countries to face radicalization. But one of the things that really strikes me when listening to Bunny Vaughn, particularly season two, is just how much this radicalization process that we have spent so much time talking about overseas and in certain communities in the United States, but not others, really closely resembles what you describe happening in a lot of these cases. I guess what I want to ask you is what has this investigation that you've been pursuing really taught you about what radicalization looks like in the United States? And how does that fit in how we should think about what it means to responsibly engage in public space and ideas and ideology, and how we talk about a lot of these ideas that seem to have entrees and intersections with these past radicalization?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think that, you know, with journalism, you know, I was talking to my students this week, my journalism students, about how, you know, it can be really uncomfortable when you hold a mirror up to people and they don't like what they see, and they want to blame you for that instead of thinking more about themselves. You know, I think that there's a little bit of mirror holding up in Bundyville that I realized I had to do, because, you know, I've lived in the West my entire life. And, you know, I've had a lot of people on both sides of the political spectrum, on all sides of the political spectrum, about the government or, you know, different interpretations of tyranny, I guess, and things like that. And so as we've seen these sort of like plague of mass shootings and this kind of like sickness rotting in our society and not knowing how to fix it, how to cure it, it felt, I guess, sort of like darkly serendipitous to be working on Bundyville, where I'm sort of like trying to root out what the ideas are that are driving people to commit violence, and then seeing a lot of those same ideas coming up again and again within, you know, these mass shootings and things like that. So I don't know. I mean, I think that I worked on this project and I started it as fairly clueless, you know, knowing that right-wing extremism existed, that these were right-wing extremist groups, but not really, you know, ever understanding why, like what drove people deeply, like what their deeply held beliefs were. And, you know, I guess now, like, the big takeaway for me is that people of all stripes can be radicalized, and that a lot of times when people are in pain, they, whether it's because of a lost job or a feeling of desperation, for whatever reason that is, they may find kinship with other people who are in pain. And those people may have pretty dark ideas about how to fix it. So I think that, you know, I see Bundyville kind of everywhere now. I see it in headlines about mass shootings. I see it in the way, you know, President Trump talks about, you know, people from other countries. There's sort of this, you know, inability to sort of look yourself in the mirror and see what the history this country is built on. And the country is built on racism. It's built on violence. It's built on a lot of things that I'm not sure we want to be about. So, yeah, I mean, I think Bundyville is sort of like this continued study for me as a journalist to sort of look deeply and closely into these corners of the world with patience, trying to understand like how it is that, you know, people can become violent and evil, I guess I would say.
Well, on that note, we are unfortunately out of time today. But Leah Totile, thank you so much for your work on Bundyville and for joining us today here on the Lawfare Podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Lisa Tilley's podcast, Bundyville, is produced in cooperation with Oregon Public Broadcasting and Long Reads. You can listen to the podcast and read Leah's related series of articles at longreads.com/Bundyville, BUNDVILLE. The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please take a moment to share the podcast on Facebook or Twitter and to leave a review wherever you may have found us. Your audio engineer this week was Michaela Fogel. The podcast is edited by Jen Pachihau, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thank you for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.